Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome, folks, to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, I'm Michael Steele. You can find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. You know that. Also, check me out on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the labor pains of the Mueller report, the anticipation of whether it'll be a little baby Mueller or a big baby Mueller. And so we got the little baby Mueller. Well, now, folks, we're getting ready for the big baby Mueller, all grown up, because the Mueller report, we're told, is going to come out. That's just one of the things that's exciting the hell out of folks in Washington, D.C. over the last few days. And certainly with the tax man coming next week, there are a whole lot of folks focusing on their own personal tax affairs. And so we may get a little bit into that as well. And to help us sort of sort it all out is a guy I've known a long time and worked with for a long time. He's one of the smart, bright lights out there that's left talking about core Republican values. And there are some of us out there doing it. It's the one and only Bill Kristol. He is the editor at large of The Bulwark. He was a founder of the Weekly Standard and is a regular guest on leading political commentary shows. I get the chance to sit across the table from Bill from time to time on MSNBC. Prior to his work at the Weekly Standard, Mr. Kristol led the Project for the Republican Future, an organization that helped shape the strategy that produced the 1994 Republican congressional victory. Yes, this brother has had his fingers on the till, trying to guide the ship of state, as it were. Welcome, Bill, to the Michael Steele Podcast, man. It's good to have you.
Good to be with you, Michael, fellow old-fashioned Republican who believes
right.
in the rule of law and free markets and, you know, American leadership and all that. But it's there are a few of us. Maybe there'll be more of us again.
Well, you know, and I think there will be. And I think that's a good place to start, just as a jump-off point before we get into Mueller and a lot of the other stuff that's going on. You know, you and I have been in the throes of a lot of battles, and it's always been around the ideas of staying true to core principles and values, the things that have defined Republicanism for generations. And recognize, you know, what that means to the American people, how conservatism works and why it works. In your estimation, how did the party in such a, I mean, stop and think about it. You're talking about this 150 plus years of sort of building up this narrative with some really smart folks like Buckley and others, you know, who were laying out the philosophical mandate, and guys like Reagan who, you know, changed that and turned it into political power and policy. How did it all go so ass backwards in literally 18 months?
I mean, historians will want to, you know, write a lot about this. I mean, I think Trump, you know, individuals make a difference. And if someone else had been nominated and won or lost, I think we'd be having interesting debates about how to modernize a lot of principles, which one, what issues we might have been wrong on, where we just got some things, you know, we just had a view that was out of date or that was incorrect. But, you know, on the big, big picture things, American leadership in the post-World War II world, the free markets working, free trade working, rule of law, constitutionalism, limited government. I think Republicans have basically been right. All these things need to be addressed to current circumstances. But Trump won. I guess in retrospect, you could say the Iraq war going badly, at least for a while, certainly. And then the 2008 financial crisis, both of which happened, obviously, on a Republican watch, did some damage. But on the other hand, Republicans did pretty well, as you know, when you were chairman in 2010. Yep. And then in 2014, and Romney ran a respectable race against President Obama in 2012. So I wouldn't have predicted this. It's obviously worldwide, the kind of upsurge and populist sense among the people that the elites are out of touch, and they are in some ways, but on the other hand, an awful lot's been accomplished, too. And that is, I guess, what's most striking to me, where it was sort of the party now has the attitude towards that it kind of hates what America's become, you know, and it's going to make America great again by turning against, ethnic diversity, turning against trade, turning against immigration, turning against America's role in the world. Those are all things that have served America well for the last 50 years, really for the last 150 years, as you were saying. And,
right.
And we've also, and so it is, I think we just need to make the case and hope that the fever breaks a little bit. And Trump is a good demagogue, though, and he obviously has tapped into things. And once he won, you know, it just becomes so amplified, obviously.
What are some of the drivers there? I mean, one of the things that I took note of, just as a student of the party and its progression, was in the post-Reagan era, there seemed to have been this sort of, you know, big question that was left unanswered. Who would be the next Ronald Reagan? And it was this sort of slapdash to figure out who that would be, and sort of the internal roilings began to emerge between Republicanism and conservatism, because, you know, under Reagan, they sort of came together in a very nice little package. You know, the boat was loose in some spots, but he was able to tie a lot of those loose ends together. That began to unravel. There seemed to be this separation between the idea of conservatism and Republicanism, etc. And then Trump sort of stepped into that void and started filling in pieces, if you will, of that narrative. And a lot of it seemed to sort of play to people's fears and concerns. It just strikes me as odd that Republicans, at least those who self-profess or declare themselves such, and same for conservatives, became this sort of this group of fearful people, afraid of immigrants, afraid of the alliances that we had, distrustful of institutions. How was Trump able to sort of pick at that? Was that a scab that we just didn't know was there, or is it a new wound that he's opened up?
You know, some of both, I think, if you pick at a scab, but it obviously gets worse. And President Obama, I think the reaction to President Obama, in the sense that he's getting away with things, drove people a little crazy.
Right.
The conspiracy theorizing. I mean, you know, think about it. When Trump did the birther stuff in 2011, 2012, I think all of us just thought this was crazy and sort of wasn't going anywhere. No major Republican picked it up. Fox News didn't pick it up much. He said it on Fox and Friends, I guess, each week. But I was on Fox till 2012, and I was on the big shows, really. And it was very, I don't recall anyone taking that seriously. Maybe there were one or two who did, but not the bulk of people. So I think in 2013 or so, things really went kind of started to go conspiratorial and, bitter. And the lines between, you know, tough partisan criticism and just kookiness started to evaporate, you know, to be blurred. And obviously that's just continued for the last 5-6 years. So in the last day or two, President Trump has twice accused his opponents of being treasonous. That's his term. Both the FBI and Justice Department people involved in the Mueller report, and then Democrats, because they're allegedly for open borders. I mean, I just, that language for a president of the United States, I mean, is really astonishing, and something that conservatives, above all, the liberals too, obviously, would have said is just dangerous and inappropriate and really, you know, reckless almost in terms of what it conveys about, you know, your fellow citizens, one's fellow citizens, either half the country who vote Democratic or people who work in law enforcement and the Justice Department and the FBI. And you know, Trump does it, and it's basically cricket so far as I can tell. I was sort of looking on Twitter and then, you know, around online a bit, and I didn't see a whole lot of Republican elected officials or pro-Trump, you know, intellectual types say, "Woo, boy, this has gone too far."
Right.
Which I do think in the old days, they would have said that.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And it is, again, I think it was his ability to sort of step into that space, create the angles, and people kind of move around and tap into a lot of concerns that have been built up over time, where, you know, like, for example, on the Supreme Court and things like that, where people thought that promise just wasn't going to get kept anymore. And he came in and he said, "Hey, here's a list of judges I'm going to appoint from this list. And, you know, the migrants are coming and they're taking your jobs, and you need to be concerned about that." So that fear factor for, I think, a lot of people just sort of exploded. And it was astounding to me that the other nominees at that time just didn't have an answer. They didn't have an anecdote to what Trump was saying, which I think spoke a lot to that earlier battle I was referring to, that inside the party they just didn't know how, because they didn't know which side things would come down on. So it was like, oh, you would just play it safe. And as we learned, certainly with Trump, you can't play it safe. You gotta be balls to the wall. And I think that's one of the things the Democrats are going to find and are finding. As a president, despite everything else right now, Bill sits with a 41% reelect, which, you know, as I told a couple of Dems the other day, you know, getting to 47, 48, a plurality is not going to be that hard. And so they need to think about these things.
Yeah, I mean, they're a little befuddled by the moment, too, I think. And they have their own, you know, extremes that are pulling the party. And so it's not a good time in American politics for anyone to say anything responsible about the debt, about trade, about American leadership. And, you know, being the candidate who says, wait a second, we can't just do what feels good for 1 second, or we can't just have policies based on anxieties and frustrations and anger. I mean, the anxieties and frustrations could be correct, but if you do something that makes the situation worse, what have you done, really? But that's right. Trump is really good at exploiting the anxieties, and you can't sort of push them away. So I think the odds are Trump doesn't get reelected, just because that 41% is a low number, but the Democrats are capable of bungling it. There's no question. Sure. So it's going to be an interesting year and a half, that's for sure. But yeah. first we get the Mueller report, so that will be an interesting little moment too, I suppose.
Well, and let's dip into that. What's your take there? Barr putting his fingers on the scale the way he did with his little 4-page musing about the report, and then sitting in testimony before Congress and basically, you know, saying, well, you know, I can't give you my thoughts about this. What you did, you put it on 4 pages and you said that, you know, that the president was exonerated. But now we're going to see something, I think, very different. Well, how do you see this Mueller, the next storyline in the Mueller narrative playing out?
I mean, obviously, I don't know. I've got one or two thoughts. I mean, my main thing I want to say, though, is it seems like so old-fashioned and earnest to say this. People should really just read the report.
And yeah, exactly.
You know, and they really should read. It's going to be, I think, written in a pretty, you know, interesting way. And not, you know, I think it'll be a narrative mostly. They can skip parts that are very, might be boring, legalistic discussions of whether this crime or that crime applies to something. But just what did the Trump campaign do, and what didn't they do? What did Trump personally know about? What didn't he know about? What, right, as president, did Trump do in terms of Comey, in terms of Flynn, in terms of the Mueller investigation itself, in terms of dealing with his lawyers, Trump Tower meetings, so forth? I think that will be very interesting. And I think everyone's gotten so, and I don't blame them, but it's gotten so into the legalistic side of it, and does it meet the barrier for the standard for a crime and stuff, and obstruction of justice and all. But, I mean, I think as citizens, let's just assume that Trump is not going to jail in the next year and a half. He can't indict a sitting president, seems to be the consensus. Let's assume he's not going to be impeached, which I think is likely correct. Mm-hmm. Then we as citizens, as Republicans, but also as citizens in the general election, have to make a judgment on him. And I think people really should just sit down and read it and say, is this the kind of president I want? How damaging is it? Maybe it won't be that damaging. Maybe people will say, look, he did a few things he shouldn't have done, but campaigns are always messy, and the president's always put a little bit of a thumb in the scale, and, you know, it's outweighed by good things he's done. Fine, if that's what our fellow citizens judge, that's what they judge. But I think people really need to sit down and sort of take it seriously, as I say, not as, like, amateur lawyers, but as citizens of a republic.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of value in what you're saying there, because for me, it's always been, which is why I've been very careful in opining about the report or about what Mueller was doing, because there were no leaks up until recently where I felt they figured they needed to come out and say something the way Bill Barr had sort of characterized their work. It's going to be in the eye of the beholder. Everyone's going to take the papers, the 400 pages, and they're going to read them, and they're going to walk away with, sort of a baseline understanding of, as you said, what happened, what didn't happen, what the president knew, what the president didn't know. And then from there, they'll layer on their political perspectives in terms of, well, what does it mean, you know, for the president's future electoral prospects or even, you know, further litigation. But you can't do that until you have the paper. And so all of the gnashing of teeth and prognostications about what it is and what it isn't, to me, seem to serve one purpose and one purpose only, and that was to predefine what we thought or what we think we're reading or what we're under, you know, see in this report. So, and that's a part of what Trump's been doing. I mean, getting out there and sort of, you know, saying, see, I'm free, and there's no big deal here, keep moving on. He knows that people are going to get the report and take a look at it, but he wants them to look at it from the sense that, well, there's nothing here anyway, so let's move on. But I think you do have to take the time to read it and understand exactly what it means and what was behind this investigation in the first place. And I think the noise has been the biggest distraction, if nothing else. I admire Mueller for avoiding a lot of that, but still, those narratives are out there, and people are going to have to, like you said, take their time and go through it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Trump tried very hard in the last, you know, when the Barr summary came out, the Barr letter came out, to really make that the moment where people's opinions firmed up. I think he didn't succeed. I mean, there's no evidence in polling that he really convinced anyone except people who already were his true believers. So I feel that, you know, people are keeping a reasonably open mind about the report, about what they might learn, and we'll see. And obviously, not everyone has to read all 400 pages. People can read some trustworthy summaries and excerpts. But I just hope we, you know, have a serious discussion. And I think this is where, and the lawyers are fine. Obviously, I read them too, and it's great to have a legal analysis, sophisticated analysis. But a lot of this is also just about, you know, what does it tell us about Trump and the Trump administration? And so that I think is also going to be interesting. So I kind of think the system has worked pretty well despite all the efforts to prejudge and pre-spin.
Right.
And I guess we'll see it pretty soon. Huh? It'll be an interesting moment.
Well, and leading up to that interesting moment, you had the interesting moment that's just breaking, and that is with Julian Assange. Now losing asylum in the embassy and has been arrested by British authorities, and now the long battle for extradition to the United States begins. Do you see, is there anything in you know, with the WikiLeaks, particularly given the way Trump sort of pumped up and promoted WikiLeaks during the campaign, which I think was just probably more theater than maybe the substance of it. But do you see any connections, potential connections there, or narratives that emerge around Julian Assange's new status, if you will?
I mean, I can't judge whether there's sort of legal implications and the like, but I would say this, you know, these were clearly WikiLeaks set up to be stolen documents. Now, there are, you know, to make public stolen documents. Now, sometimes there's excessive secrecy, and sometimes you could argue journalists and others do a service when they reveal secrets that the government is keeping illegitimately quiet. Though it was the Obama administration, after all, that was, you know, from whom these documents were being stolen, and that prosecuted Assange and Water 2 and WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning and all that. And so it wasn't exactly just right-wingers who thought, geez, you know, you really kind of hard to run a foreign policy and hard to run a military if all these documents get leaked. And the same I'd even say is true of the lesser things, the Podesta emails. Fine, you know, John Podesta is not dealing in state secret 20 emails to some other people on the campaign, but it's not. People shouldn't steal other people's emails, you know? And the fact that Trump and his people were so happy to promote those, and they didn't even have a caveat about, look, on the one hand, no one should steal anything. On the other hand, I mean, you could imagine a normal politician saying this, right? Like,
right.
You know, on the other hand, look what it shows you. Well, okay, but at least you would have the caveat at the beginning that it's inappropriate to do this, because Trump, it was, of course, just encouraging people to do it. And again, I think it shows how our standards have really collapsed. And do we just want to live in a political system where just everything is up for grabs? You know, anything gets stolen, it can be used. There's no compunction about urging other people to break the law on your behalf. I mean, that's really what Trump was doing. It was a little bit, I agree, kind of jokey and almost, you know, I don't know, serious, like, legal offense, but it was still revealing that he did that. And so, I mean, I'll be curious to see sort of how the whole Assange thing is, what the reactions to it are. The left is kind of torn a little bit. They kind of don't like government secrecy, but they kind of know this was really bad, and they don't want all journalists to be tarred by Assange and WikiLeaks. They sort of like sometimes getting these leaks, and parts of the right, I mean, amazingly, are going to be torn too, because the pro-Trump right is sort of pro-Assange, you know, whereas traditional conservatives are like, really? I mean, the guy, you know, stole a ton of stuff. Some of it was seriously detrimental to our national interest, and that can't be permitted.
Well, yeah, so you raised some very interesting points there, Bill, because I was listening to a number of journalists as this was breaking on air this morning, and the fact of the matter is there were some who were like, you know, not outright defending, you know, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, but to the point that you raise, saying, you know, what do we do when we have access to this information that's made available to us? And the journalists, you know, they're like, look, these are documents, or this is information that should be in the public. And how do you walk that line? Is it the source of it, meaning it was stolen or hacked off of a government computer, or that's the line, the bar that's too far, or the line is too far to cross? I mean, how did they start to draw that? I mean, because the Assange case has always raised a very interesting conundrum for me when it comes to the public's right to know versus the public's need to know versus the journalist's opportunity to access that information to get to the public. How do you square all of that? I mean, if the bulk were to get their hands on some good stuff, what do you do? I mean, how do you go through that process?
Well, there were times when the Standard was either, you know, we got our hands on stuff or offered stuff. And there were times we looked at it and we actually consulted with people sometimes who were experts in certain aspects of the field of national security who said, no, look, some of this is maybe technically classified, but it's not.
Right.
You're not at any risk of damaging, you know, U.S. national security interests. You're not going to expose CIA agents to retribution, et cetera. There are other times when you look at stuff and think, well, I don't even want to know about that. I'm not going to publish it. It's not appropriate. So I think journalists have their own decisions to make, and, you know, they run some risk of prosecution if they go too far in one direction. But generally, we sort of hope that responsible news organizations will exercise their judgment. But stealing the stuff in the first place is another story. That's pretty unambiguously illegal. So, but no, I agree. There'll be lots of interesting discussions. I hope there's more self-reflection. The media got awfully high and mighty and self-righteous in the Bush years, and, you know, nothing they published could be, you know, that there was no, everything had to be exposed. Everything was being covered up. And I think maybe actually the last few years have exposed, you know, made people a little more reflective about that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And so they have a comparative narrative that they can look back on and say, you know, this is what you were touting under the Bush years. And now you seem to have a different song that you're singing. And a lot of circumstances have changed for sure. But again, I think the idea of self-reflection and the process that these organizations have in place to protect national interest and, you know, field operations and things like that. Certainly, I think Assange has caused more consideration of those things than just, oh, we got the story, let's go run with it. You know, I think that's a whole different ball game. So the other big storyline that's emerging parallel with the Mueller report, and some would argue one of the reasons why the president is rehyping what he's doing on the Mueller side, is the battle over the man's taxes. there's very interesting moments with Steve Mnuchin recently in which he made it very, very clear that he was not going to release the president's taxes. House committees are like, well, no, you're supposed to give us what we need because we've asked for them. What's your assessment on this battle over the tax returns? I mean, let's just, for the record, folks, This is the longest ass audit in the history of audits, by the way, that the president's undergoing here. I forget now what year tax returns are under audit. Is it the 2015 taxes? But anyway, what's your assessment, Bill, on this crazy?
And the audit thing is just nonsense. I mean, we have other presidents have released presidential apparently tax returns routinely audited, and they always release them. I always have for 40 years. There's a law. No one has ever found it unconstitutional. You could challenge it. Anyone actually, the chairman of Ways and Means can request anyone's tax returns, and it would be in private and stuff as a way of checking on whether there's special favors being done. It kind of came out of Watergate. On the one hand, it's sort of weird to me that if you don't want some congressman just randomly looking at people's tax returns. On the other hand, it would be there'd be a record of their requirement. Right. There are times if there's an accusation that Michael Steele's gotten some unbelievably, great deal from the Commerce Department at the request of the president because he's a buddy of yours. It's not ridiculous for Congress to say, well, we'd like to just make sure that's not the case, So I don't know. I could argue that either way. Presidents, in any case, have always released returns in the modern era, and so. You do have to ask what he's hiding. I don't know what will happen legally. I think he might actually end up having to, the IRS might have to release those returns under, threats of contempt of Congress and so forth. But, what is he hiding? It's just sort of astonishing. Makes you wonder really what's in them. Because in the sense that no one's going to be surprised at this point by a fair amount of tax evasion and,
non-charitable giving.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that can't just be it. I mean, Bernie Sanders, who's also resistant to releasing his tax returns, I guess maybe will finally next week. Presumably what that will show is he's not as generous as you think a liberal, progressive, liberal, socialist type might be. Maybe they make more money than they realize.
Well, that's
going to
show he's a millionaire, which he's had to get out in front of that narrative. People who've actually made wealth. And then, just as a quick sidebar, Bill, to sort of throw it off like, well, I wrote a best-selling book, and you can write a best-selling book and become a millionaire, too. Oh, really? So that was your hard-earned labor that reaped a profit for you and your family, where that's okay for you, but all the other bitches out there, you're like, nah, y'all part of the problem. These liberals, they drive me nuts with that crazy, man. Come on.
Yeah, and that book is, of course, came out of the campaign, right? I mean, it was sort of, it only became a best-selling book because of the fame he got in public office, which is fine, I guess. But I mean, why is he so nasty about everyone else's money? But anyway, it's hard to believe that Trump, not a thing like that would affect Trump. So you wonder sort of there's more serious stuff in there, but I guess we maybe will know, maybe we won't. I mean, it is part of a general, an administration which, and a business in Trump's case, a White House, in terms of Kushner and others, their security clearances, their travels, their dealings with foreign governments. There is an amazing lack of transparency, not just to us, because I was in the White House and, how it works. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, of course, you do privately. You don't publicize your meetings with every ambassador or with every foreign secretary or what you say. You don't invite the cameras in. If they're in, you kick them out, and then you have your private meeting. And I have no problem with that. And you can have confidential phone calls that you don't tell anyone about. But you do, within the government, have a certain amount of sharing of information to make sure that everyone's on the same page, to make sure no one's doing anything either corrupt or foolish, And that, for me, having been in the White House, the Kushner thing for me is the most astonishing. The idea that you would go over to Saudi Arabia, a very problematic ally, if it is an ally, and meet with the head of the kingdom and the dictator, the guys running the place, who's just murdered an American resident or arranged for it, and not exclude the sort of ambassador, never apparently report back to the State Department. So you're just like doing your own little Trump business there, and he's got business interests over there, and his brother, I guess, maybe was on the trip with him, if I'm not mistaken, and has business interests. I mean, the whole thing is such a commingling of private and public, of such an ethical, bunch of landmines that any previous administration, if they had done that, would just get skewered for and wouldn't do it, honestly. I mean, I really don't believe whatever you think of Obama, Bush. I mean, there were one or two instances of that. If they happened, they were scandals and people got fired.
Right.
We just have this taken as routine in the Trump White House.
And yeah, it is. It is definitely routine for sure. And I think part of the problem is the system trying to figure out how to self-correct to get the information that it wants. because the presumption has always been in the past either that information was voluntarily offered up by the candidate or the president or incumbent member. And now that refusal to offer that up, the system is like, what do we do? The state of New York is trying to figure out a workaround where there's legislation down in the state legislature in Albany that I thought would be rather interesting. That the commissioner of the New York Department of Taxation and Finance would be permitted to release any state tax returns requested by leaders of three congressional committees. So if we can't get the federal return, the state of New York is willing to offer up the state return, which will likely contain some crossover information to the federal, particularly if there are all these accounts that some people suspect have been set up, these dummy accounts that, you know, sort of hold assets of various interests of the president. That'll be an interesting play. But again, it's all this sort of triangulation by the established order of things that ordinarily would just say, okay, we made the request, here are the documents, boom. Now having to figure out how to get what they want within the proper legal means. And that's been high drama in and of itself.
Right. I mean, I'll let you go here in a minute, but we should probably go do some work. But I think it's an interesting case study where the institutions are sort of trying to figure out how to contain and react to Trump, and I think in some ways they've done a pretty good job, honestly, and the government's, you know, moving ahead in a lot of ways and isn't, you know, all full of, not every agency's full of corruption, and plenty of civil servants are doing their jobs, the military's doing its job, and law enforcement, and state and local governments, and of course the private sector, and universities, and media, and all that. So in a way, it cheers me up about America that, you know, you can have a president who's willing to do a lot of shady things, but the whole country doesn't kind of go down the tubes as a result. On the other hand, it can do a lot of damage. He's the president.
All right, before we let you get out of here, what are you working on at the Bulwark? What storylines are you guys...
Well, we're actually just preparing for Mueller mostly and doing some other interesting coverage too, obviously, and also the whole question of whether there'll be a Republican challenger to Trump. So plenty to talk about. Maybe we should do this again in 2 or 3 weeks and we can have another conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So folks, check out the good work over at the Bulwark. You can find them at thebulwark.com. He's Bill Kristol, the editor-at-large of The Bulwark. Hey, man, thanks for taking time to come on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. All right, folks, that does it for this week. You know you can catch us on iTunes and TuneIn and Apple Podcasts and all that good stuff. Check us out and certainly follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. But before I go, just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know what happens to most of us at some point or another? Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, how can we make this much and still have so much debt? Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. Now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save. And take control of your finances with a loan from BestEgg.com. Visit BestEgg.com/plan. That's BestEgg.com/plan. We'll be back for some more fun next time. Take care.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.